Well, being a Chicagoan, I'd love to pretend that this is anything different than what I'm accustomed to, but it isn't. And matter of fact, Chicago this week had temperatures of 30 below Celsius, so I'm actually lucky to be here instead.
Great. Okay, so let's first talk about your position as the representative of American authors. What are the biggest issues right now concerning the profession in general in the US?
Oh, I think that the biggest issues have to do with authors no longer have any allies. They fight with their publishers about the royalty rate on ebooks. There are massive corporations that have now entered that space, like Google and Amazon, that have their own interests. Google wants to use everybody's content for free. Amazon wants to depress the price of books in order to be able to capture the market. There are libraries that want to lend books remotely, meaning you don't have to come into the library. There are academics who, because there's no longer any money in academic publishing, would like it if there were really little to no protection left to copyright. And it's hard for authors to look around and see who's on their side besides readers.
Well, having a long experience both as an attorney and an author, and now being again for the second time the president of Authors Guild, what do you think there is to be done about the situation?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the Guild, the Authors Guild, has been very active in filing lawsuits. And, I think some of the most outrageous instances, like Google's copying of 20 million books from the university libraries, had to be challenged. And we'll see what the courts make of that ultimately. I remain confident that we're on the right side.
Well, one thing I also wanted to discuss is that, well, the Americans are known to spend a lot of time in their cars.
Yeah.
So, because of that, audiobooks come to question. What do you think from author's perspective about this big coming of audiobooks?
I like audiobooks a lot, frankly. And if you're lucky, your first experience of literature is having your mother or your father read to you. And so I think audiobooks have a very primal appeal. And I listen mostly to poetry on audiobooks rather than novels. But, I like it a lot.
From the copyright perspective, are there any problems, or do you only see it as a positive matter? Is there any legal issues concerning audiobooks?
Well, traditionally, the rights to audiobooks have been licensed separately. Along came Amazon with the Kindle, and of course, it turned out that the Kindle had a capacity to read to you. So, and Amazon just threw it out there, acting as if they didn't realize that this was a massive copyright violation. They waited again to get, to be threatened with suit before they turned off that feature in certain titles that are carried on the Kindle.
Quite ironically, one of your novels are staged in fictional Kindle County.
Yes.
What do you think about this connection?
I have never known what to make of it. The person who's the head of the Kindle program at Amazon is from Chicago, where, of course, my books about Kindle County are most popular. So, but I have no basis other than that to suspect that there's any connection.
Well, I already mentioned that, most of your novels are about legal sphere and courtroom. So probably your two professions affect one another, but what sort of elements have you brought from real life to your novels?
Oh, you know, I certainly bring my experience as a courtroom lawyer to every novel. I started out as a federal prosecutor, and, you know, I think that if you woke me up in the middle of the night, I could still tell you what the rules of evidence are for a specific question. I could make an objection in my sleep. So I think that, you know, that experience infiltrates my novels, and I try to be very, very faithful to the legal milieu as I know it.
Thinking the other way around, well, of course, trying to win a case in courtroom requires some sort of storytelling skills. What kind of use do you have for your fiction writing in courtroom?
I hope that my experience as a novelist contributes to my understanding of the psychology of the defendant and the witnesses and sometimes the jury. I think that understanding narrative has made me, for example, a much better writer of a statement of facts in a brief where you're summarizing the supposed facts of a case. So, you know, the two professions feed each other in many ways.
Well, looking to your latest novel, Identical, there is some sort of connection to your own childhood. Can you tell me a little about that?
Sure. Identical is about identical twins, and twins loomed over my childhood because my sister, who's a little less than 3 years younger than I am, had been carried as a twin, and her twin died in childbirth, and the lost twin and the sort of mystery of what happened to that twin were very perplexing to a three-year-old and for quite some time in my childhood after that.
So you're also adapted this sort of thematic to your novel. How does it show in your... Of course, there are two twins in the book, but what other elements does this your own personal memory bring to this latest novel?
Well, obviously the element of the twins is the thing that depends most heavily on my childhood experiences and my concerns about what it would be like to have somebody who was exactly like you, and what kind of a bond that is. But you know, somebody pointed out to me when I was down in Italy and I was talking about one of the major characters, Zeus Cronin, who is the father of the girl who gets murdered, and was talking about Zeus, and somebody said, well, it sounds a little like the way you talk about your own father. And I had not thought about it once, but it's a point well taken.
Obviously, many people are interested in your dual role as an attorney and an author, and you've studied both of these fields. When you began as a young man to write fiction, did you have a sense back then already that this is going to be something that works also for a broader audience?
When I first started writing fiction seriously in my late teens and early 20s, I wanted to be the next James Joyce. And I spent a lot of time wondering about the obligation of the novelist to appeal to a broader audience, and I ultimately decided on my own that that literature, that as Ezra Pound put it, you know, that will never be understood by the bullet-headed many, meaning people whose heads were thick as lead, that I didn't share those attitudes, that I thought the ideal for all arts is to be universal and understood by a wide audience. My problem is I didn't know how to do that. And until I recognized, while I was a young prosecutor, the sort of immense, compelling power of crime, and even more interestingly, my own interest in crime, that had always been there, even though I had been very slow to recognize it, I didn't know what topics that might be gripping to me would also be gripping to a wide audience. But once I embraced crime as a subject, I was both a better writer and a more accessible storyteller.
Well, crime and courtroom, I guess you've had an influence to that, that it's a popular theme in literature and in television. Actually, I think here in Finland they watch a lot of American courtroom shows. One particular was Matlock.
Matlock.
What do you think about Matlock? Have you watched it?
Of course I've seen Matlock, although I tended to think of it as a star vehicle for Andy Griffiths. But I can't say that I thought of Matlock as being among the best of the courtroom dramas. I have to be honest.
Which ones are?
Well, in terms of accuracy, Law and Order has long led the league. Americans right now are crazy about a show called The Good Wife, and that's both very popular, and I haven't watched enough of it to know how accurate it is, but it really is a sensation right now.
You grew up in Chicago. There was this TV show just recently starring Kelsey Grammer as the mayor of Chicago, the boss. The show was canceled after two seasons, but what's your sort of like insight to that? This show about power?
Yeah. I think my problem with Boss, of course there are corrupt and brutal politicians, but I think it's more interesting and closer to the truth, and certainly that was the truth I was trying to portray in Identical, that there are actually well-intentioned people in political life who are often overwhelmed by circumstances and even the demands of democracy, but who at least in their heart have an idea of what the right thing to do is and try to do it.
So it could be that there are, well, there's like these two sides in every human being, good and bad. Well, it's a bit of a cliche, but I was coming to my next theme, which was this sort of Greek mythology thing that you have also here, and they are also Greek, from a Greek background, these figures. What's your point of interest there in this Greek tragedy?
You know, I think because of the way the issue of this lost twin loomed over my childhood, it seemed to me to have a kind of mythic dimension. And so when I started to conceive of this book, it was natural that I was attracted to the Greek myth of Castor and Pollux, and you know, the identical twins of Greek mythology, and there's an aspect of their story that they are identical in every way, except one is mortal and one is immortal, that when I began to contemplate it, I thought could really fit well in the novel I was thinking about writing.
Well, Mr. Turo, let's get back to the, well, author's life in the U.S., you mentioned that you're concerned about some things, but you also are very optimistic about certain legal cases, well, that they're going to do well. But, well, looking at it from another perspective, literature in general in the U.S., what's interesting from your point of view right now?
Well, I am one of the judges of the Hemingway Prize, which is given to the best first work of American fiction. And, you know, I've been reading many of the entries, and we have to begin to narrow our selection this week. I think what's been interesting to me, of course, are the influence of fantasy on short fiction in the U.S. You know, just by way of example, one of the books under consideration includes a story about a girl who grows a tail. And the other is the almost universal simplicity of the storytelling style. The very straightforward, shorter sentences, and pretty undecorated vocabulary. So if you ask me for the current trends, those are two.
So James Joyce is not as a stylistic figure and an issue at the moment.
Well, yeah, no, that's very interesting you should mention that. Another of the things I've been doing, I'm working on a preface for a book of columns that appeared in the New York Times Book Review, in which different authors talk about what they like to read. And Ulysses and James Joyce, which was sort of the icon of world literature when I was a freshman in college nearly 50 years ago, is no longer an icon. And although there continue to be many, you know, good, even great authors who respect Ulysses, there's a much larger number who have a lot of very unflattering things to say about it these days.
How about your own favorite, Saul Bellow? He went to school with your father, right?
He did. My dad and Bellow were in high school together. Until Bellow died, I somehow did my best not to remember that. And then the week Bellow was gone, I realized that. So I think, you know, in exploring Bellow, I was obviously also trying to come to terms with my dad. But I love Bellow's work. The richness of the language and the way he managed to combine the high-flown intellectual rhetoric with, you know, the energetic vernacular of the street was really remarkable. His descriptions and the excitement of intellectual life that's portrayed in Bellow's novels is those are all things I greatly admire.
To conclude our discussion, just talk a little more about the book market, the literature market in the U.S. Of course, you have a very vast domestic supply. You have lots of authors writing. You have English writers. Is there anything coming from outside the English-speaking world?
Well, Americans are notoriously xenophobic. Many of the Scandinavian mystery writers have been quite popular. Ionescu has a real audience in the United States and several others. But with that exception, and occasional novels that, you know, break barriers from Western Europe, the truth is that there's much, much more U.S. fiction read abroad than there is fiction from abroad read in the U.S.
Yeah. Must be the same thing with films and music, and because there is this sort of like world order of cultural products. But one thing I was wondering, one more thing was that, well, to many people it's hard to get that you can work both as an attorney and an author. Mm-hmm. So how do you manage?
Well, I haven't practiced full-time as an attorney since 1989. So there's a little bit of sleight of hand. And the other big point to emphasize is that because of the success of my novels, I really, for many, many years now, have not really practiced law to make money. So if you're free of the financial constraints and the time constraints, it can actually be a very enjoyable profession. Because you take the cases, certainly I've taken the cases that I want to take. I can say no to anything without having a guilty conscience. And so it's been really easy for me to combine the two careers.
I understand that these are quite sensitive issues, talking about your clients, but could you just, like, naming no names or something like that, just give an example of a case that you've handled during the last years?
Sure. I tried a criminal case about 2 years ago. I represented a physician who had been charged with criminal neglect because a patient in a nursing home where he provided care to the residents, the patient in the nursing home had died. And the prosecutor's theory was that even though the injuries that ultimately led indirectly to this woman's death had been inflicted by the nursing home staff, the prosecutors thought that he should have come over to the nursing home and looked at the patient. There were several things wrong with the prosecutor's theories about that. One was that he made monthly visits if the patients in the nursing home needed urgent care. They had standard instructions to go to the emergency room. In this case, though, the doctor had records showing that he had specifically instructed the nurses to go to the take the patient to the emergency room, and the whole case depended on a nurse who I thought was pretty clearly lying, and more important, so did the judge who was hearing the case. After the prosecution rested, the judge threw the case out, said that this witness was simply not worth believing and that no rational person could.
So there was one example, quite interesting. To conclude, well, now to really conclude this interview, does it ever happen that one of your colleagues or your relatives or friends recognizes themselves from a novel written by you?
Well, I've had people think they recognize themselves. One of the most flabbergasting to me was one of my colleagues from the U.S. Attorney's Office who claimed that she was the model for the woman with whom Rusty Sabich, the protagonist, has this torrid affair. And I really have no idea what she was talking about. I thought it was fairly amusing, but I couldn't even imagine that she would claim that.
Hey, Mr. Turow, thank you.
Thanks, John.